morning. I'm Julie Bronker, the president of the society, and looking forward to the start of the new year. And Rosemary Lester's service, she says she's got changes to announce, but first we'll have announcements. I have a couple of announcements here that were given to me ahead of time. Please return your guests at your table boxes next Sunday, January 10th. You're safe. You have one more
I'm
week.
Safe. Forgot.
There will be a collection box in the lobby, or you can call Judy Scope. Judy also has an announcement that she has school board nomination papers for Carol Carstensen. CARE will undoubtedly run someone against her. So if you have any questions about that, you can ask Judy. I mean,
if you saw the note in the newsletter, there is a choral group getting together to participate with Martin Luther King service. And if you'd like to sing and be a part of the prayer group to go to that, please let me know. The first practice is on Saturday this week, and the performance and another practice are the Saturday after. But we need to know how many. So if you could let me know today or tomorrow.
Okay, I do know that today is the Prairie Fire deadline, so if you have anything for the Prairie Fire, make sure you get it to Dick Bonser by 6 o'clock this evening. He is here. If you have anything, you can give it to him after the service today or leave it in our mailbox. I want to announce that we finally have copies of the registration papers for the Women's Spirit Conference. It's going to be at First Unitarian Society, January 29th, 30th, and 31st. They're limiting it to 300. It's a very popular event in the district and sponsored by the Women and Religion Committee of the Central Midwest District. And several people from here have gone to ones in the past and have really enjoyed it. So there are registration forms out on the registration table in the lobby. We received the Central Midwest District newsletter, and there are several copies in the flyer box here. Any more announcements?
They're also looking for housing.
Yes, they are looking for housing, and I don't know what happened to the forms they had out for housing. Things got moved around. anything else? Mike?
There will be no program committee meeting tomorrow night.
Okay. Any more announcements? All right, then I will turn the program over to Rosemary Lester.
Thank you. A question first that just occurred to me. Is somebody doing a children's thing?
They're doing it downstairs.
Oh, they are already downstairs. Yeah. Okay. All of a sudden, yeah. I thought, my God. Yeah. Grandmother, and I didn't prepare anything for children. But I would like to light the chalice, or the candle in the chalice. Any luck? And I'm lighting this chalice today. I'm a little nervous. I'm lighting the chalice today for the victims of attacks and terrorism, right-wing terrorism in Germany, and for the hundreds of thousands of Germans who are standing up and not just standing by as during the Nazi time, in demonstrations in solidarity with the many foreigners who are living in Germany. And I was very glad to see that, for example, Leslie Gelb, a Jewish columnist for the New York Times, in his list of good news, thanking for good news in the year 1992, included that hundreds of thousands of Germans demonstrated, almost 2 million now, they took to the streets to protest racism and violence against foreigners. These protesters, he wrote, represent the new Germany, a democratic Germany, and they deserve more leadership from their leaders. And I thought that was a very good statement. I have to do what speakers at conferences never should do, and that is to start with a disclaimer. The Cowboys, Indians, Hogan's Heroes subject, I didn't quite get that done the way I wanted to. It will come up with a few slides at the end when we can have a discussion. But instead, I decided to translate into English a radio essay that I wrote and broadcast and spoke in Germany in the Southwest German radio in 1983. And that was a time when there was a lot of research, writing, and public discourse on the subject of prejudice and racism going on. The title of that essay was How Prejudice is Learned. And of course it has to do with Germany, it has to do with the images and stereotypes. And perhaps at the beginning of a new year, it isn't such a bad idea to reflect upon the concept of prejudice, which is certainly one of the things that played not just this century or the last, but all of human society for a long time. And it is, I'm going through this, I found really it's applicable today to this society, to German society, and so forth. After that, I'll have a few slides that might serve as a basis for discussion, but I hope that after you bear with me and let me do this essay for you, these reflections on prejudice, that we can have a lot of discussion, heated discussion, perhaps. Okay. As every good scholar does, you start with an example from the Enlightenment. In a letter dated 29 April 1757, the German Jewish philosopher Moses Mendelssohn wrote to his friend Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, who was perhaps the most important Enlightenment philosopher and author in Germany, and I quote, "I am amazed when I ponder the power that prejudice has over the human mind. Everyone, to the best of his ability, seeks to weave together the truths that he knows with his own favorite prejudices. And after he has enjoyed this woven cloth for a time, he believes to have built his system on a sound foundation." For Lessing, as for the representatives of German Enlightenment in general, prejudice was essentially an error of cognition that could be corrected by education and practical experience. Of decisive importance for this learning process, however, was the willingness of the individual to constantly, critically check his or her own opinions and to serve as an example for others. This idealistic belief in the perfectibility of humankind found its perfect dramatic expression in Lessing's Nathan the Wise, the famous drama of religious tolerance that was, of course, forbidden under the Nazi regime. But immediately after the fall of the Third Reich, one of the emigres, one of the greatest, most well-known German Jewish actors returned, and he played Nathan on the stage. It was quite an event. Roughly 200 years later, we do know a bit more about the complicated mechanics or mechanisms of prejudice formation. And heaven knows we've had enough experience with prejudice. Only that willingness to be self-critical, to learn to rethink, that somehow doesn't seem to function. For our prejudices are dear to our hearts and cost others dearly. And yet, no human is born with an insuperable antagonism against blacks, Jews, Turks, or other minorities. Prejudices are learned, and the first lesson a child usually receives at home in the familiar, immediate familiar environment. Through gestures or words whose meaning is not even understood, certain sympathies and antipathies are transferred to the child. A sudden, perhaps unconscious tug upon meeting a group of Sinti gypsies during a walk in the park, this was a particularly German example, a spontaneous, "I gucke mal in nature," this is Frankfurt dialect for, "Hey, look, a Negro." Such not at all unusual reactions signal rejection or make the person of another color an exotic curiosity. These patterns of reaction are quite important in a child's later ability to sort out and evaluate social phenomena, especially those which are not his or her everyday realm of experience. For example, the valuation of members of foreign countries, ethnic groups, significantly different religions, or even social groups. Examples for the latter two might be the many adherents of Islam in Germany or the homeless in this country. Still, it's not easy for children to transform the adults' prejudices into corresponding modes of behavior. Gordon Allport, whose seminal research and writing on prejudice are standard works in Germany, too, he's an American scholar, tells of a six-year-old who had been admonished by his mom not to play with, quote-unquote, the niggers. His answer, no, mommy, I never play with the niggers, just with the white and the black kids. The youngster had learned the language of prejudice long before he could make a connection with the reality of his playmates. We have a similar situation with the countless disparaging colloquialisms, the epithets that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, in everyday language. In German, for instance, Krümeltürk, literally caraway seed Turk, because of eating habits, or Spaghettifresser, roughly spaghetti slinger, though fresser is really the term used for animals eating. Such common terms are relatively harmless. But the child who couldn't even identify or a Turk or an Italian yet, hears such a word, picks up a somehow negative sound, perhaps the corresponding facial expression, and will only much, much later make the connection with real people. And if he's really had bad luck in selecting his parents, our child, he might pick up a verdammte Kanaka, a very common derogatory term, or even Negerhuge, Negro whore, in a conversation about the new tenants in the neighborhood. And he probably can't help but hear the grown-ups laughing themselves silly, sharing the latest Mustafa jokes. Mustafa is the prototypical Turk in ethnic German jokes, German ethnic jokes. Prejudices then are laid on children, laid on or hung on, whatever you want to say, sometimes laid on children by adults, sometimes quite literally, as a devastating press photograph from an American magazine of the 50s shows. I've used that in my dissertation. A 5 or 6 year old girl is demonstrating in front of a school in Louisiana. Around her neck hangs a sign as big as the whole child, and printed on it in clumsy letters, "I don't want to go to school with the blacks." You probably remember signs like this. A West German companion piece, though without the immediate political implications, was an elementary school celebration under the motto, "All the Children of the World," taking place in 1972 in Frankfurt. The fourth graders had a special treat for their parents. Dressed in black bodysuits, they too had cardboard signs hanging around their little necks with the legend Schwarzer Neger, black Negro. And in the middle of their classroom, there stood a gigantic cooking pot with the sign Cannibal Lunch. Mm-hmm. Teachers and parents thought it was funny, oblivious of or insensitive to the fact that here, the dehumanizing colonialist image of the little black savages, which incidentally has a strong and long-lived tradition in German, was playfully transmitted to little white children. But then, 20 years earlier, in 1951, nobody had minded a certain float at the big Cologne Fasching parade. Fasching is something like Mardi Gras. A float that carried little German kids painted black. They too carried signs painted by grown-ups with the message, "Made in Germany." That was the time when heated public discussion had begun about the fate of the so-called colored occupation babies, the offspring of black American soldiers, the first of whom had just entered public school, encountering a frequently hostile and racist public. Of course, the children on the float couldn't grasp the full impact of the spectacle, but they surely had their first lesson in racial insensitivity for beginners. The racist thought structures underlying such jokes have never been part of a systematic public discourse in the Federal Republic, though they've certainly been discussed more and more by Africans and other minorities living in Germany, and of course scholars, media critics, and so forth. And yet the images present in popular culture with their seemingly harmless trivialities are among the worst, i.e. most effective, disseminators of prejudice, precisely because one does not take them seriously. It's just a joke. But there's nothing funny about some currently popular Turk jokes, told mostly by high school kids, that are making shocking reference to the Holocaust. Why then do we have such a hard time parting with our prejudice? because actually they're useful. Prejudices stabilize in a kind of perverse manner one's own feeling of self-worth and social identity. And they offer the chance for security and warmth, albeit a treacherous one, within one's own ethnic or social group. It's much easier to run with the pack than risk being attacked by it. Hence, we find prejudicial behavior more frequently with, in German it's called ich schwache Persönlichkeiten, persons with a weak self-concept. And you can read a lot more about that in detail in Adorno and Horkheimer's famous work on the authoritarian personality. Adorno, some of you know Adorno and Horkheimer, others don't. They are two Jewish refugees who had founded, very famous sociologists who had founded the Frankfurt School of Sociology. And when they were in America, they wrote the work, The Authoritarian Personality, trying to deal and analyze this phenomenon. When they later on, by the way, Angela Davis in Frankfurt studied at the Frankfurt School of Sociology. And of course, nowhere can you get this needed self-elevation cheaper than with a prejudice against blacks. The mere being white, the simple biological accident of skin pigmentation, suffices to feel superior to entire nations. And if you can even get God into the act, well, we've all heard the familiar, if God had wanted them to be equal, why did he make them black? But in order to fully understand prejudices, we have to look at their historical societal origins and functions. For their usefulness is not limited to the individual psyche. Most of you probably know the myth of Ham, to be found in the first book of Moses in the Old Testament. The son of Noah was punished by his father by the curse, thou shalt be the lowliest servant to your brothers. This myth then was embellished by some of the early apocryphal writers, making Ham black and giving him curly hair. And finally, Ham was supposed to be the father of the black race. Well, in the 17th century, this myth was widely used to give a sort of divine sanction to slave trade. In the 19th century, of course, pro-slavery American pastors and priests used it quite a bit as a justification. And not surprisingly, in the early 20th century, it was still being kicked around in Calvinist circles of South Africa. But let's take another more specific example. During the peak years of colonialist expansion, roughly between 1870 and 1918, one dominant image of the black emerged in literature and significantly so-called scientific and anthropological writing. Africans as a race of enormous strengths and vitality, but no intellectual capacity for abstract thought. They were seen as naive, overgrown, irrational children, and thus they were, in effect, the perfect raw material for the firm hand of the colonizers, a perfect justification stereotype. Much of the writing on this, incidentally, originated in France, in part in order to convince public and government of the benefits of a large colonial army contingent, an army made of colonial subjects. And it is no coincidence that the Count Gobineau's famous essay Sur l'inégalité des races humaines, an essay on the inequality of the human races, suddenly became a huge success in the late 1900s, parallel with colonialism, after attracting almost no attention when it was first published in 1853. Numerous anthropological treatises about the true and essential characteristics of the Negro, as well as virtual how-to books about his proper treatment, suddenly flooded the market and handed a moral justification to the colonialist politics of the Wilhelminian Empire. Interestingly, the socialists and social democrats were against these policies. The bottom line, to use this awful term, was in all of these treatises, the education, I quote here from one of them, the education and training of the Negro takes time and physical punishment. He must first become a made up whip. Then he is a willing and useful worker. And during that same time, there emerged that pernicious and persistent stereotype in the form of countless cartoons, illustrations, and advertising images that reduced the black African to a grotesque and dehumanized bad joke of creation. Ring through the nose, sausage lips from ear to ear, cannibal cooking pot. I have a couple of examples even from the 1970s and 80s in slides. During the 1950s and 60s, and that was the time of decolonization in Africa, it enjoyed a tremendous upsurge in popular publications, and photo features and commentary on the events in Africa revealed that clichés and prejudices dating back to colonialist times had survived two world wars unscathed. But that's really the topic of another paper. Many of the prejudices that have plagued our century really crystallized during the late 19th century, and one of them is the prejudice against, quote-unquote, emancipated women. For if we trace the history of the German women's movement back to that particular time, we're talking about the late 19th century, we note first, though relatively modest, successes. They did not yet include the right to vote. That came in 1918. But quite a few other civil rights. But even those modest advances of women unleashed a torrent of scholarly treatises, this time about the true and essential characteristics of the female. Sound familiar? The similarities were not intentional, but both women and Negroes, according to these treatises, seemed to be driven by instinct and emotion alone. Both had smaller brain volume and hence were unable to think abstractly or rationally. Both needed a strong guiding hand. Quote, makes woman animal-like, dependent, and cheerful, wrote Paul Möbius. Über den physiologischen Schwachsinn des Weibes. The title means On the Physiological Retardation of Women. And he concludes films that came from it. He wrote in the middle of the 19th century when his books are as popular as ever today. In fact, I read them under my blanket when I was supposed to go to sleep with a flashlight under the blanket as a school kid. And I cried bitter tears when Winnetou, the hero, when he died ultimately. I really love this text. And this is a recent advertising. You always have the images of Winnetou. There are about a million of these printed every week. The comics, the Reno Kid and Chief are purple. They're extremely popular. But there's more to it than just the trivial stories here. There are about 63 Western clubs in Germany, in West Germany, and they meet once a year, and I'll show you just a few slides of their meetings. These are ordinary, well, somewhat less than poor, because the stuff is expensive. They have fine leather Indian and cowboy clothing and tents, handmade tents and so forth. They meet once a year and they really cherish this culture. Mm-hmm. And when you think in terms of a very small, relatively small, highly densely populated country, this idea of the wide open spaces, the cowboy riding off into the sunset, has a tremendous attraction. And once a year in Frankfurt, I'm sure you know that, is a big 2 or 3 day country and western music festival. And it's amazing when you go there, you see the people in these very expensive leather clothing and 10-gallon hats. So it takes money to belong to this. But there are sort of social psychology reasons for that sort of thing. Yeah.
You're aware that that's a very popular movement here as well. It's a rendezvous.
Yeah, and, okay, but I mean, this is here.
Yeah, I understand. but
it's still acting.
I'm curious if there's the implicit linkage there that there is here to the survivalist movement.
That is a later aspect. These are still slides from, I think, the early 80s. One of my students gave me those. And there is now, lately, a trend to look upon Indian culture as a much closer to the earth, healthy culture with respect to nature and to the earth. But that's a different group again. Those tend to be members of the Green Party or at least in that direction.
Yeah, but here there's a strong link to a society can go to hell, but I've still got my gun. I know how to defend myself.
No.
I know how to survive without modern technology because this is the way in which I can create my fascist enclave.
Yeah. No, there's no link to that.
It may not be true, but there seems to be that.
Well, the Germans have had a long history and interest in Native Americans because if you take anthropology or archaeology and you want to take as your second language or your official language, you usually take German. Because so many studies in anthropology and archaeology are done in German.
Some excellence.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
And this is the sort of the popular side of this scholarly interest. Okay, this is something I won't go into at length anymore. The next slides are just sort of ancillary to what I've talked about previously. And particularly my concern was always with how children are indoctrinated. This was given to me in the early 80s by a woman who had the wife of a pastor, who had adopted two little African youngsters and who had encountered quite a bit of prejudice and problems. And this was the advertising of a shoe store, a very well-known shoe store chain, and the kids got this. This is for the children's shoes. And if you look at this imagery, the missionary there looks very nice and handsome. And look at the horrible cannibal there, you know. And so this imagery is still carried on. And this was one of the worst. It's a very popular sweet in Germany that was called, it used to be called, this no longer exists, but this is from 1981. They are called Negerküsse. It's a marshmallow covered by chocolate. And some of us had been writing and talking forever, it seems, to get people to stop that, you know. And if you go into a store sometimes, I go to a bakery where they have that. I love to eat the stuff, you know. And I would ask for Schaumküsse, like marshmallow kisses, or maybe Frankfurt kisses, why not? And they would be so astonished, why am I saying this? And then you try to do a little grassroots teaching, and you meet with utter astonishment. You know, it's a long run. But in the long run now, they don't do this anymore. And that is a result of, not mine particularly, but many people's persistent efforts to get rid of this. This I got, the Fushing's Ball, this is the famous in February, you know, the Mardi Gras Ball. In my neighborhood where I live, they had this in 1984. And I went in and said, hey, I'd like to talk to the people who made this image. And it turned out they were some very sedate, nice ladies of the church, of the Lutheran church. So I had a little visit with them, and they too, it was hard for them to see anything but just good, clean fun in the image. It's a ball, you know, a Fushing ball, which means a costume ball, dress-up ball. And one of the most favorite costumes is always the Indian and the cannibal. And of course, you know, with more and more, particularly Africans living there, there is a lot more protest voice. This was in 48, in 84, and I had a hard time with the ladies of the church. But here, this is 1986. This was a children's book that dealt with, again, all the children of the world. And all of the children of different countries had their native costume. The only one that was grotesque was African children. See, that's what I mean by the persistency on this kind of cliché, which is really, really bad.
And they've got the Maasai sword in the jungle even, and the Maasai wear the neck things.
Yeah. Right. It's totally grotesque. But just to show you an example, this picture of a working woman in Mozambique, and an old man in Mozambique. This is from a children's book published in the GDR. And of course the GDR, one must honestly say, did not print this sort of thing. They focus instead on, of course, the workers' process and the importance of defending the country against the white imperialists and so forth. But I haven't done intensive research yet, but I haven't found any really ugly stereotypical images in their publication. Now, this is an example from 1977 that shows you what you can do with a stereotype, what you can do politically with a stereotype. Notice you have the cooking pot, and it's entitled Germans in Southwest Africa, which is Namibia, an old German, former German colony. Under the cooking pot, Egon Bahr, who is a very liberal German politician, is stoking the fires. And on the right side, of course, is a black Castro figure. So you see all the political implications in there, focused on those poor Germans in Southwest Africa. And this was printed not by a mainstream paper, but by the Deutsche Nationalzeitung, which was the newspaper of a small, very right-wing nationalist party. The party never did make it into government or anything like this, but it was one of those early right-wing nationalist groups.
German-speaking population of Namibia hasn't been German by nationality since 1914,
that's
of course,
right.
But they still...
Well, you know, they hold a lot of traditions, and of course there were very close relationships, culturally and economically, with South Africa, the government of South Africa, and Germans, even to the point of when at the beginning of the Second World War, what's his name, Forster? The one who was even proposing joining by way of a fifth column with the Nazis? The one who landed in jail finally was this Ossewa Brandwatt, one of those very rightist organizations. And the Germans, these kind of Germans, I mean, the extreme rightists are still keeping up that idea of the old colonies where the blacks were so happy and so forth. And of course, those who lived there are very close to the country and they were born there. But still, the cultural and sometimes political traditions were upheld even while this was in the 70s. But I just wanted to show what you can do with a stereotypical image, varying it, using it, you know, for all sorts of statements, political statements. I'm not talking about advertising, there's a lot of stuff in advertising.
Is the shape of the German politician's nose significant on that one?
Is the what?
Is the shape of his nose significant?
He's not Jewish, but they made him look like that. This, of course, is racism and sexism, which are always bedfellows, not very strange bedfellows, it's almost to be expected. See, the guy in back, is his wife's in the cooking pot, and she says, "Don't you dare, Karl Heinz." And this kind of sexist, racist joke, this is from 1981 still. But typically in a very right-wing magazine, popular magazine. So I don't think you'll find those now anymore, but I mean, it's bad enough to find them still in the 80s. I want to close with this, which is kind of an amusing sidelight. This is a man-sized statue of the so-called Hofmoor, the court Moors, and you know, starting with the early Renaissance, there were black court Moors that were sort of high-class servants. There was slave trade going on there in Europe, not just in Germany. But the image of this black courtier is a very popular one, and the woman who ran a cleaning shop on the corner of the street where I lived had this thing in a big, big box to the tune of 998 marks. This is a catalog offering. And it was bought by a 22-year-old Greek guest worker in Frankfurt. A young woman, the so-called foreign worker. And she put that into her apartment. So this, I thought that was kind of a funny side fight. Yeah, okay, now let's turn on the light maybe and get into some more discussion. If there should Oh, God, it's already almost enough. I'm always flying.
I've always understood that the basis of prejudice was the desire of the prejudiced person to look down on somebody.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
How does this occur with children being raised in a family of prejudiced parents? Do they just adapt the prejudice, or do they also get the feeling of being...
Well, from the sketch I did in the beginning of the talk, you know, you pick it up, and we have social psychologists here in the audience who are much more qualified perhaps than I am. Kids pick up things in nonverbal communication. Remember this little example by Gordon Allport? They pick it up.
Think they're also picking up the poor self-image at the same time?
Well, you know, I cannot go into a really deep... It's possible, but you have several things that feed into prejudice. I'm not saying, and the literature does not say that all of the prejudicial people who are prone to prejudice are people with poor self-image. There is a tendency, there's always just a tendency that the majority of those who have been researched seem to show that. That doesn't say that there aren't some other ones too. There are, you know, in psychology.
But that would be a basis for hatred, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, it certainly would. And if you think in terms of the poor whites in America, in this country, the only class they could look down upon were the poor blacks. Mm-hmm. And the arguments they used, for instance, they're slovenly, they're oversexed and all that, you can find the same argument by other ethnic groups or even other social groups. They have been even used against Jews and so forth. So, yeah.
This may be funny. Anyway, what strikes me is that people don't discriminate. And what I mean by that is everything is very global. Mm-hmm. They take an image of the cannibal in the cooking pot, and they can't distinguish where anybody's from. All people who are darker like this. Mm-hmm. The most modern image of people that look like that are in New Guinea.
Oh.
You know, but it's like everything we ever hear about prejudice is everybody looks the same. When you say they lump all the germs together in this variant stereotype. And so people don't look at or distinguish people. You know, and one way we have of getting together is actually being able to discern the differences. Yeah.
And of course, there is.
Together in a peculiar kind of sense.
And there is, of course, a lot of ignorance involved there, and the more complex societies become, the more there is a need for guideposts, so to hang on to something simple, you know, and that's, and you can find a lot about that in the literature too. I think you were the next.
There's a red brown car right on the corner, a little small red brown car with lights on.
Oh.
That's anybody's here.
Any of ours?
Okay,
I think so. And you.
It's right on the.
You know, I think even though some of the theories are, it's like the attribution theory, like you say about Alport, you know, if you say you have one characteristic, then you have all these characteristics, kind of like the Salem witch trial type of thing. Mm-hmm. But what I look at, looking at our culture here, we have a really limited vocabulary to talk about other people. We have just stereotypical words. When I came back from Africa, when I was first in Peace Corps after spending 3 years there, we had lived in the same house since I was 4 years old, and the neighbors were called Uncle Walt and Aunt Minnie, even though they weren't our uncle or aunt. Really nice people. And when I came back, I went over, and Walt said, after I've been talking about what it was like in Africa, and he says, Dave, there's one thing I really want to know. And this is a guy who's really nice. Mm-hmm. He said, are all the nigger boys in Africa the same as they are over here? He didn't have any other vocabulary to talk about Africa.
That's
nigger
right.
Boys. That's nigger boys.
How much of the current problems with the foreign people in Germany is a problem of the nationalistic German kind of thing versus the breakdowns with Eastern society or in Eastern Germany and the conflicts that are coming about with all the change that's going on there, and I think people must feel a lot of instability right now. And how much of it do you see is related to that, or is it just another time? Oh,
It's extremely complex. And one of the reasons Spiegel is really the only but very good news magazine, is about the Nazi kids. And it researches very carefully. There are about 6,000 organized right-wingers. The majority of the attacks now with firebombs and so forth are perpetrated by youngsters, by people from between 15 and 21 years old. And there are a lot of interviews here. And some of it is out of, it reminded me of the gangs and the bloodshed in this country, out of sheer aimlessness, no future generation, and the wish to have something to hang on to. They always come back to the idea again, we want some, I mean, those who are really thinking in terms as they're doing it. Some, there were some cases here where the three Turkish women died. That was done by, as they know now, by one 21-year-old and a 16-year-old who were sort of the outsiders in their groups. And nobody thought that they'd even have as much as the guts or energy to do it. So it's that kind of thing even that's going on. You have these 6,000 organized, not in one group, they're in splinter groups, the Viking Youth and the New National groups and so forth, who have, unfortunately, these old Nazi images, and that was a very persuasive kind of philosophy. It gave people something that they didn't need to think about, they just could hang on to it, you know. They sort of gather around the old symbols, strengths, and we need to have just the Germans. But underlying, or what triggered this rash of it, is of course devastating economic situation. I mean, West Germany is pumping about a billion marks into the East, and it's like a bottomless hole. And at the same time, there are now about 7 million foreigners in the country, but illegally, you expect about 500,000 a year. And when you have the people in East Germany, particularly, being jobless, having no job, and all of a sudden, and they see, you get so many illegal asylum seekers into Germany because Germany has, because of its guilt feeling, in the constitution, the most liberal asylum and immigration law in the world, I think. And they would have done much better to sort of pattern it to the very rational laws in this country. Cool. But not this country. Okay. But I mean, you know, with a little less.
Well, having something that's more restrictive.
Something more sensible.
For Germany?
No.
But on the other hand, you couldn't expect, when they made the constitution, they couldn't expect that what was going to happen. And so you have a large number of people coming into the country who are not political asylum seekers, but who are economic refugees. They want to get away from hunger and so forth. And so they get, thanks to these laws, they are provided with money, with a certain amount of money. They are provided with health care. They are provided with a certain amount of social security. And now you have these kids or these people in the East who are jobless, and who really would like work or training, you know, and so the simplistic reaction is, these people are getting it all, you know, and so forth. Yeah.
Not marvelous immigration law, to give you a real reason example.
Well, no, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have said that.
From Cuba, who brutally assault, you know, people on a plane, commit crimes to get in here, but if your skin happens to be black and you're from Haiti, and you're oppressed the heck out of you, we'll pick you up on the high seas and dump you back on the beach.
No, and that was really a
black students get the same good reception.
Wait a minute. Mm-hmm. You have had your hand up for
I grew up in a Baptist church on Sunday school. Our minister was always speaking about having good ideas about other groups of people, like Jewish people and black people. But in the church itself, there wasn't so much of that. He didn't really persuade a lot of people. There was a Cuban, a young fellow my age, who had immigrated from Cuba. He had rather dark skin, and he had a wonderful voice. He got in the choir, and he lasted about one Sunday, when members of the choir protested having him in the choir, and that was it.
Did you say what you were going to say?
Me?
Yeah.
It was just a question, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I think that, oh, and, yeah, you too.
I wondered what has become of the children of the Hitler Youth people. Some of that,
the children of the Hitler
Youth. The offspring of the Hitler Youth who grew up with that teaching.
Oh, you know, that's a generation now, that's in part my generation. And, there has been a lot of relearning and rethinking, and of course, at the end of the war, I mean, I was a little younger than the Hitler Youth people, but at the end of the war, of course, you know, everyone in the 50s had nothing to do but survive and try to build up again, find work, get an education, and the children then, you know, many of them went to school, to university, and there was a very strong effort at re-educating, which was not easy because you have to have a generation of teachers first who can re-educate. So that was difficult. That was very difficult in the East, too.
It's not expected that any of that trickled on.
Well, you know, there is always some trickle down, but don't forget, this is three generations removed now. And this is what makes so many young people in... one East German youngster just talked to my Spanish teacher who told me that is so devastating sometimes. This young person said, it's just awful to feel as if you had a mass murderer in your family tree and you're constantly made responsible for it. And that is, of course, that creates a backlash again if too much of that is, you know, done. But some of the children of the really, of the big Nazi leaders, and of course not, you know, not everyone was a died-in-the-wool Nazi. The people didn't stand up out of fear. There are not very many heroes around, but there were plenty who were glad when the whole thing was over. Mm-hmm. No?
No.
Okay.
It seems to me that children in any era, especially if times are not good, are looking to their history to find images of strength and power that they can relate to feel good. You know, our young people today look to the cowboys or the Indians, if you happen to be an Indian, of our own history and take those images onto themselves to feel, to feel good about. And I think this is probably equally true for the young people of Germany. And one of the most powerful images they have to relate to is that of the Nazi era.
True.
It's a tough situation for them to be in, and it would take a lot of work, I think, on the part of older and one hopes wiser heads in the Republic to educate them away from that kind of information.
And of course, within several generations, the majority, you know, the silent majority basically has been educated away, but there's also this problem in West Germany, which we've found here. There are a lot of left-wing, socialist-oriented people, and the conservative government that has been in power for quite some time always cracked down on the left-wingers much harder than on the right-wingers. And now, all of a sudden, they see what really is happening on the far right. You know, that's... I think you were next.
One of the things that my grandmother came from Sweden, and one of the things that happened with each different wave of immigrants was that they looked down on the next wave. Mm. So my grandmother had nothing but scorn for the lace curtain Irish.
Yeah.
And then later on, the Italian people came, and they were the bottom of the pile. But one of the interesting things about America is that if your skin is white, you get into the approved class by the next generation, but the blacks can't because of their skin.
That's why I found these things about the course about the skin so devastating, really. George.
Someone, I think it was a German Marxist, once said that anti-Semitism is a socialism of fools. And what he's getting at is very often there may be the same personal dynamics of a person drawn to socialism or communism as there is to prejudice. Namely, feeling discriminated against, feeling oppressed, feeling injustice, but instead of blaming the ruling class's exploitation, they pick on a minority group to blame them. Mm-hmm.
Do we have one more?
I think not.
I have almost 11:15 and we're supposed to start.
Oh, thank you so much.
Sorry about that.
Rosemary, to look in the paper and see a picture of 250,000 or however many
yes.
it was standing for human rights and not and against the kind of things yes. that have been going on.
And they have a constitution, yeah. which they didn't in the
It's interesting to look at another country, but I think what you start off to say is part of it looks at us being self-examining also. And I was reminded when I saw this that was it 5 years ago when the fraternities here on campus
yes.
had a slave
yeah.
auction.
They had a cooking pot up there too.
Yes, yes. So
that's right.
It's interesting to look at another culture, but some of it reflects on our own, unfortunately. We're going to sing 28, the Gedanken sind frei.
Since we don't have family nearby, even around very far, the holidays have been a time for sort of reestablishing some ties with our prairie families. And so we'd like to share greetings both with people we visited and people who were here in Madison. And I guess it just sort of symbolizes, being in prairie for a long time, it really has become a family with ties around. We spent the holidays with our very close friends, Mel, Anita, Mickey Mattarella, whom few of you know, who are in Michigan. And Nina is now in medical practice after many tedious years in medical school. And Peter is a wonderful sophomore in high school. And Andrew, little baby Andrew, is 9 years old and a very active fourth grader.
Very active.
Yeah. Delightful. And we also got to visit with Henry and Annis Pratt in the Detroit area. And then some of you got to see Eleanor and Ori Laux, who are now in Ohio. But, you know, again, this is part of the family group. And I was just thinking of somebody else that we've had contact with.
Just in the reverse.
Oh, we can.
Oops. Well, the Dops are here in town. Norma and Mike's kids. That's what it was. Their kids had been our kids' babysitters, and when we told Anna that their kids were going to be home for the holidays, one of the things she wanted to go see them more than she did some of her classmates. And so that was sort of fun to get to see them again, two out of the three of them from faraway places.
Well, we saw, my daughter was home, and we were standing in line at the grocery store, and who should be behind us but Eleanor and Kim, and I said, this used to be one of your babysitters. So, you know.
Speaking of that kind of joy of seeing someone unexpectedly, well, this is not unexpected. I went to New Orleans. Lee and I went to New Orleans for Christmas, and we had a very nice time. And we got back on Tuesday. It would have been nicer if we hadn't had to. Our flight hadn't been canceled from Chicago to Madison, but we got back anyway. But we're standing on Monday in the Aquarium of the Americas, which is very nice. And we're just standing around, my mom and dad and stuff. And a guy walks up and says to them, I think you're my cousins. And it was a cousin of ours, who we had not seen, a guy my age, who we had not seen in 20 years, and wow, with his son. So it was like this big family reunion.
Oh my goodness.
So it was really nice. It was very totally unexpected, and it was like, oh, how are you?
Back in home country.
Exactly. Any more? Dave?
I had a joy happened yesterday. Sometimes I feel, since I've lived in other cultures, that when I look at my own, it's hard for me to connect sometimes. And movies and things that are going on. Yesterday afternoon, I saw a movie at Majestic, Flirting.
Oh yes.
It connected with me like I've never had. It's a story about an Australian boy in an Australian boarding school who meets a Ugandan woman at the boarding school, and it is just fantastic. It just did something to me. I walked out of the movie, and I just felt something like I haven't felt in a lot of movies I see. There's some good ones. That one's just excellent. So it's really
true.
That was a real joy. Yeah.
Any other joys or sorrows?
Hi, I'm Brandy Borkus. I'm from Union Church, Joliet, Illinois, and I'm just really happy to be here today. It'd be so far away from home and have somewhere to come and connect. And just feels real good. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to see people I've seen for a while. One of my pleasures recently, last night, was to see Anna, who's been away on the West Coast, and to see what a marvelous young woman she's growing into. Such self-confidence. And another pleasure was to sort of get at an old arch-computer rival of mine, who wasn't able to print his daughter's files on his computer. Macintosh, you were
Shirley?
I visited with Callie and Jennifer with Hazel. They sent greetings to everybody. Doing okay?
They're
there.
Are they pretty much housebound now, Shirley?
Pretty much so, yeah. But they're glad to have somebody come by and visit. Mm-hmm. We took dinner over there and had a very pleasant time.
I'd like to say something. Last year, my circle dinner took our potluck to their house, and they really enjoyed it. Oh. So if somebody has a potluck close to that neighborhood, it'd be nice.
Well, you need to check ahead.
We did.
I know, but for other people.
Yeah.
The other thing is, Tally really likes singing, so if anybody wants to go over and sing for or with him, he might enjoy that.
Just have those people commenting about somebody did come and sing with them. Mm-hmm. I'm happy if they were with us.
Hi, my name is Tracy Erickson. This is my first time here. I'm just here as a visitor today. And I just like to say, you seem like a very nice group of people, and you're very welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce our friend and neighbor, Mary Quidell.
Also, she's a fellow classmate in the Spanish class for years. And Rosemary Lester is going with our Spanish class to Costa Rica on January 10th. And these two people will be rooming together. So I said, Mary, you've got to come and meet your roommate.
Rosemary, I got back from 2.5 weeks in California about 10 o'clock last night. When I heard that Rosemary was speaking.
Oh, what a roommate!
Any other joys and sorrows? Then we usually move into introductions.
Thank you for the ones. But if anybody else is visiting and would like to introduce themselves, we'd be glad to meet you so we can spend some time afterwards talking with you.
I'm Bob Purvis. I met a bunch of you a year ago at your Upper Woods
retreat. Oh, yeah, okay.
My two children, Tiana and Amy.
Welcome.
My name is Ted Mallock, and this is my first time here, obviously. And this is my friend Randy that came up from Illinois. And I'm really glad to meet you both.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Barbara Wyatt, and I'm here visiting with my daughter, Lindsay, who's now here.
No? Any other introductions? We have one more song.
Page two at the bottom.
Page two at the bottom. Who are the Patriots?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yes.